we knew we had to bring everything with us in the event there is ever an incident.
The federal government signs off on Shell Oil's Arctic Spill Response Plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Air Force Chief of Staff meets with Fairbanks residents to explain the plan to move Eielson's F-16 squadron.
I don't think that at this meeting that there's anything that Fairbanks is going to say to the Chief of Staff that is going to change his mind.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The federal government has signed off on Shell Oil's spill response plan for the Chukchi Sea, clearing a major hurdle for the Houston oil giant to begin drilling vast Arctic Ocean reserves off Alaska's coast during the 2012 summer open water season. Shell spokeswoman Kelly Otteve says this is a big milestone, but there's still work to be done.
We still have an authorization that we need to get from National Marine Fisheries, and we also have another authorization that we need to get from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And then finally, and very importantly, we need to have the actual permits to drill approved. We have begun that process by beginning to submit some of the documentation to receive those permits, and we'll continue along that process, and that will continue in several weeks to come.
Otteve says one rig is in Seattle now, and another will arrive next month or in April. The well sites in the Chukchi are more than 1,000 miles from the nearest Coast Guard base. Otteve acknowledges the lack of infrastructure and says that's why the spill plan approved today by the Interior Department includes on-site, near-shore, and onshore resources and an oil spill response fleet.
We knew we had to bring everything with us in the event there is ever an incident. The new plan also includes a newly engineered Arctic capping and containment system, and that is being built right now, and we will test that before drilling begins this summer.
Arctic Ocean drilling is opposed by environmentalists who contend oil companies can't clean up a crude oil spill in icy waters. Wilderness Society Alaska Region spokesman Tim Woody says the decision is a disappointment. He says meeting the federal requirements for a spill plan does not translate into the real ability to recover oil in Arctic and winter storm conditions.
They managed to recover about 3% of the oil in the Gulf of Mexico after the BP Deepwater Horizon spill. It's hard to believe that anybody in the oil industry can claim that they're going to recover, you know, a high percentage of oil in the Arctic when they've been unable to do that anywhere else in the world under much more hospitable conditions.
The federal government estimates Arctic Ocean outer continental shelf reserves at more than 26 billion barrels of recoverable oil and 130 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. The North Slope exploratory well that experienced a blowout on Wednesday appears to have stopped flowing. Spanish oil company Repsol's well hit a shallow natural gas patch that kicked mud, gas, and water back up through the drill rig. Repsol shut the rig down and evacuated the area. Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Engineering Commissioner Kathy Forrester says the well ceased flowing at 11 p.m. last night. She says Repsol and Wild Well Control, the company hired to get the well contained, are now setting up to begin the process of thawing the drill rig. Forrester says the rig system is filled with fluids, and because it's been shut down for more than 2 days, those fluids are frozen.
And we have serious concerns about the mechanical integrity of all of the systems on the rig that have been holding frozen fluids. So before that rig is recommissioned to work, we're going to have to do all kinds of checks on the integrity of every bit of that system.
Forrester says Repsol and Wild Well Control are building scaffolding to set up equipment for the thawing process. She says the thaw plan is complicated by dropping temperatures from 8 above yesterday to 18 below today. Forrester says the immediate focus is ensuring the well is completely killed and not just temporarily blocked by mud or ice.
You know, we're not going to assume that the well has depleted, because if we assume that, you know, we're setting ourselves up for injuries and more problems, because it could just be bridged off or an ice plug plugging it off. So we have to assume the worst, and they're going to kill the well first. Even if it's already dead, they're going to kill it again. So that's the first step.
No workers were injured or oil spilled at the well near the mouth of the Colville River. The Department of Environmental Conservation estimates about 42,000 gallons of drilling mud were released on the gravel pad and snow-covered tundra. Air Force Chief of Staff General Norton Schwartz meets with a group of local officials in Fairbanks tomorrow. General Schwartz is coming to explain the Air Force's planned movement of Eielson Air Force Base's F-16 squadron and as many as 2,000 of the base's 2,700 people to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. The Air Force proposed a similar move in 2005 during a federal base realignment and closure, or BRAC, process. The Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation led a campaign that stopped the move, but Fedco CEO Jim Dodson says this time around, there's no BRAC commission to petition.
General Schwartz has got approval of the Secretary of Defense. He's got approval of the Secretary of the Air Force, and he's embedded in this process. So, you know, I don't think that at this meeting that there's anything that Fairbanks is going to say to the Chief of Staff that is going to change his mind.
Dodson says it's good that the borough is hiring a consulting firm to analyze cost savings the Air Force says will be realized by moving the F-16 squadron to Anchorage. Similar studies undermined alleged savings during the 2005 BRAC. Dodson says the focus should be on any upcoming BRAC that could target Eielson for closure.
The battle line, I think, should be drawn on, you know, maintaining the base and a future mission, you know, for the base. And that really is a battle that needs to involve the governor and the congressional delegation and the community. So it's not something that, you know, any of us can win alone. I think it's going to need a collective process, and hopefully everybody will come together to make that happen.
Dodson suspects Alaska isn't alone facing military cuts, but the state does not have as much political clout in Washington. Dodson says he has some hope for legislation sponsored by Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski to stop funding of the F-16 move. Following tomorrow's session with General Schwartz, the senators will host a community meeting about Eielson at the Carlson Center in Fairbanks. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, legislators introduce a bill to reestablish an Alaska Coastal Management Program.
It's the program that makes all of the agencies and the people involved and communities sit down at the table and work things out.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Rasmussen Foundation, accepting online nominations for the 2012 Distinguished Artist Award until March 1st. Learn more at Rasmussen.org.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at ArcticWireRope.com.
A bill reestablishing an Alaska Coastal Management Program has been introduced in the State House of Representatives. House Bill 325 is largely the same as a citizens' initiative on track for a statewide vote later this year. Lawmakers can preempt the measure by passing substantially similar legislation. The bill was introduced by 7 members of the House Majority Caucus, including Kodiak Republican and Majority Leader Alan Osterman as primary sponsor. Osterman could not be reached for comment this afternoon. Minority Leader Juno Democrat Beth Gertula signed on as a co-sponsor as soon as the bill was introduced.
For me, it's maintaining people's ability to be part of the process and for Alaskans to be able to have the right to speak up against federal government on its activities and projects in Alaska.
For more than 30 years, the Coastal Management Program gave the state and local communities greater input into federal permitting decisions along Alaska's coastline. It also helped developers by streamlining the regulatory processes of various state and federal agencies. The program closed last year after lawmakers and the Parnell administration failed to reach a deal to reauthorize it. The administration and some House Republicans fought efforts by rural lawmakers and Democrats to expand the role of local communities. Kurtula, who once worked as a coastal management lawyer for the state, says the program gave Alaskans a voice they now lack.
It's the program that makes all of the agencies and the people involved and communities sit down at the table and work things out. And while the huge companies might have a whole permitting department and it may not be quite so difficult for them, it's pretty hard on the smaller companies or the individuals who want to go get permits that affect the coastal zone.
Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello is a prime sponsor of the Coastal Management Citizens Initiative and chairman of the Alaska Sea Party, which has been advocating for its passage. He says the group would prefer the legislation take action. If lawmakers wait to see if voters pass the initiative, Botello says the proposed program would not get up and running until at least the summer of 2013.
It speeds up the process by at least a year. Legislation that is enacted now could be in place in the FY 13 budget cycle, which is to say after July 1st, 2012.
Botello admits the Sea Party would also like to avoid a costly and potentially divisive campaign to pass the initiative. He says the group would need to raise at least $500,000 to challenge any opponents and convince voters of the need for a program. While HB 325 closely mirrors the initiative's language, lawmakers will have significant leeway to enact substantially similar legislation. Botello expects some changes as the bill moves through the committee process, but says the Sea Party believes certain provisions must remain part of the final legislation.
One is to make sure that all permitting agencies are part of the coastal management process. And second, we view the reestablishment of a coastal policy board as an important means by which local districts have meaningful input in the shaping of statewide standards.
Governor Sean Parnell this week said he prefers a public vote on the Coastal Management Initiative. Another Alaska-based movie is premiering, like the recently released Big Miracle. On the Ice is set in Barrow. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the films are very different.
On the Ice is billed as the first Inupiaq film featuring an all-Inuit cast. The movie is directed by Andrew Akpeaha McLean, who grew up in Barrow and Fairbanks. It tells the story of two teenage friends who try to hide the truth about a tragic accident that happens while out seal hunting with another young man.
Everybody's so freaked.
They think he drowned.
What the hell happened?
That's my knife, man!
How did you get my son into? I didn't mean to! What did you do?
McLean says the story is an outgrowth of his successful short film called Sikumi that was a winner at the Sundance Film Festival in 2008. He says the characters are based on people from his grandfather's life, but that the story is contemporary and fictional. McLean says it taps a Western frontier theme of being beyond the law and morality, and the setting is central to telling the story.
This wide open vista, this incredibly vast landscape, and that's where it's you get that sense of freedom. And then that's contrasted with the locations in town. And they kind of give the opposite sense. They give a sense of being closed in. The community is very tight-knit. It's, everybody knows everybody else. Everybody knows exactly what everybody else is doing. And everybody cares about everybody else, so there's kind of a warmth to it. But then at the same time, it can also be suffocating and dangerous, especially if you're trying to hide something.
McLean put a major emphasis on authenticity, shooting the film on location in Barrow and using all first-time Native actors, people he found in Alaska and Canada. He says he wanted it to be an accurate depiction of life in the Arctic.
It paints a picture, I guess, of the community from the perspective of the story it's telling. So you could make a completely different film about Barrow that would still be completely accurate, but within the story that this was telling, I wanted it to be real. I wanted the characters to feel like real people. I wanted the place to be treated like it's a real place.
McLean credits On the Ice, which has already won prestigious awards, making it to production to the State of Alaska Film Tax Credit, which helped recover some of the costs. The film was pre-screened earlier in Barrow, but McLean and producer Kara Marku are premiering it in New York, Anchorage, and Fairbanks today. They're coming to Alaska this weekend and have several public events scheduled. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The flag drops for the 2012 Iron Dog Snow Machine Race on Sunday. This year's field may very well be the most competitive. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin in Nome, which is the halfway point for the Iron Dog, has the story.
Eight past champions will head out from the starting line in Big Lake on Sunday, along with past champions from the Nome Gullivan Snow Machine Race and last year's I-500 champion Chad Guaco. 2009 Iron Dog champs Nick Olstad and Todd Minnick return, along with three-time champions Dusty Van Meter and Mark McKenna. 2011 Nome Gullivan winner Aaron Lawyer teams up with Tyler Acklestad, and the back-to-back Iron Dog champions Tyler Huntington and Chris Olds will hit the trail, but this year they've each teamed up with racers from Nome. Huntington, who is in the race to win it, has considerable experience in the interior, having grown up in Galena. He says he is excited to be racing with Trey West, whose expertise is on the coast.
We match up, I think, just the perfect couple. We're both just about the same speed, you know, it's almost identical.
And others hope to simply cross the finish line. 14 all-rookie teams will ride, including Bethel's Gux LaRue and Stephen Boney. Having a Bethel team at the starting line in Big Lake is rather unique. While teams annually head south from the Nome and Kotzebue area, LaRue says it's been a while since a team from the YK Delta has competed in the 2,000-mile race. He says running the Iron Dog is a lifelong dream.
My father raced it back in 86. Yeah, he was the last team to run it from that area. And just listening to them tell stories over coffee, just fueled the fire to run the Iron Dog.
And of course, one team hopes to be the first to cross the finish line in Fairbanks next Saturday. The 2007 champions Scott Davis and Todd Palin have teamed up again. The two have 11 Iron Dog championships between them. 31 teams and 62 machines are set to head out of Big Lake Sunday morning. As of yesterday, the purse is set at $200,000 with contingency prizes. The winners last year received a check for $50,000. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kanin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates four decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue, Dillingham,
Sitka, Chugia, Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ed Ronco. This week on AK, volcanoes. If you've spent much time in Sitka, you've probably seen Mount Edgecumbe. It's one of Alaska's most viewed volcanoes, rising 3,000 feet from the ocean, just 10 miles from the former Russian capital. Scientists and Tlingit tradition bearers know that it last erupted about 4,500 years ago, but other volcanoes, vents, and lava flows in the area have seen more recent action. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld catches up with a dedicated group of geologists in Southeast searching for lava in the rainforest.
So we are walking down the Rec Center Road at UAS, and on our right or north side of the road is a wondrous outcrop.
Kathy Connor leads me to a rock face recently exposed by construction at the University of Alaska Southeast. The Juno geologist points to an outcrop of asbestos, veins of quartz, and something else.
Notice what's happening now, Ed. What do you see up there? Do you see any change in color?
Oh, darker.
Yes, and maybe some red?
Mm-hmm.
So what I think we're having here is just a little place where lava vented at the seafloor, and we're getting some pillows of basalts where the magma rose, hit that cold seafloor, and then gelled into a balloon or beach ball sort of shape. And now that it's all exposed, it's oxidizing and making that rusty color.
That lava formed about 100 million years ago, the quartz about 40 million. And that's the same range as similar rocks throughout the region. But elsewhere in Southeast, volcanic activity is within the realm of human memory.
The youngest basalts, the youngest eruptions that we know of, are about 110 years old.
Susan Carl is a research geologist in Anchorage. She says that lava, on the U.S.-Canada border northeast of Ketchikan, was dated by counting rings on trees caught in its path.
Because they're that young, they're the youngest ones we know of right now, it's certainly possible that more of these volcanoes could erupt at any time. We don't see them as an imminent volcanic hazard, but they certainly are something that we should be keeping track of.
It's quite surprising how many volcanics there are in Southeast.
Jim Bechtel is a geologist for the U.S. Forest Service in Thorne Bay. He, Connor, and Carl have spent the past two or so years searching for new cinder cones, lava flows, and other volcanic evidence. Carl says they've found a dozen features, bringing the known total to about 50.
Jim has given a number of talks around Southeast Alaska and shown people pictures. They'll come back and tell us, oh, I've seen one like that over in this place or that place. And that's actually how we've found some of the new volcanic centers.
Some of what they've found appears to be eruptions beneath long-gone ice flows. That excites Bechtel.
If that's subglacial, it can actually blow a hole up through the ice and it collapses back on itself. But as this thing continues to erupt, you may have an ice wall all the way around, and that's what we believe Painted Peak in behind Ketchikan is.
So why are there volcanics in Southeast? It's all tied into the region's geologic history. Basically, a series of tectonic plates, slow-moving chunks of land or ocean floor, crash into and become part of our mainland. As they collide, rub against or slide under each other, they heat up or create cracks that release magma. Carl of the U.S. Geological Survey says the region's volcanic centers line up along major faults or the intersection of two faults.
So what the faults are doing is they're providing a plumbing system. They're providing an avenue for these little puddles of melt under the margin to come up.
Chemical analysis shows the recent arrivals are part of a much larger volcanic system stretching into British Columbia and the Yukon Territory. Back at the University Rock Cut, geology professor Connor points out ribbons of quartz running through a crumbly slate-like layer. They were formed as the Earth's crust bent and flexed, which also brought a belt of gold-bearing rock into the ground beneath Juno. There's evidence that the bending and flexing may have been a result of Ice Age glaciers melting fast, allowing the land to rise. Could today's climate change caused shrinking ice fields create a similar situation?
I suppose it's always a possibility. You just have to hold on to your socks and see what comes. Yeah.
For AK, this is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're off to Dot Lake, an interior community of about 45 people.
My name is Bill Miller, and I'm presently the president of Dot Lake Village Council. Presently, we're located about 50 miles from Tok Junction and 60 miles from Delta Junction, just off the Alaska Highway. We're close enough to Fairbanks to go shop, and we're far enough away to stay out of the bureaucratic stuff. Well, it's called Dot Lake, and that's about what it is. It's a small dot. It's mainly fed through marshland from the Tananaw River. It has a few streams feeding into it. There's no actual fishing in the lake. It's too small. But it's nice view. We can look out across the flats and watch moose in the summertime and watch the beavers and muskrats and other critters that wander around. We do get some caribou come in the, during the year. We can watch them across the flats. In August of last year, our Marshateria utility building caught fire and was destroyed. And it was the laundromat and showers for a number of the local residents. It also had a central heat and water distribution system for a number of the homes in the village. And when we lost it, we basically lost heat and water for those homes. It was quite devastating. We have placed a temporary structure up to provide the heat and water to the homes that lost it. And so far this winter, that's held up and kept the homes from freezing up. We've been up 85, 95 degrees in the summer, and we have had in past winters, not this year, but in past winters, we've been 60, 65 to 70 below. For fun, there's hunting, fishing, which is a subsistence lifestyle, which a lot of the people live. Wintertime, it's snow machining. Summertime, we have a lot of four-wheeler trails. Most of the employment is provided by the tribe itself or the school during the school year.
That was Bill Miller, president of the Dot Lake Village Council. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. If you like volcanoes, we have photos, articles, and links on our website loaded with more information about Alaska's once hottest places. We also have a video flyover of Mount Edgecombe. Tune into AK next week when we'll take a look at an extreme example of the do-it-yourself Alaskan spirit. I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Lorelei Kanin in Nome. Ed Ronco was our AK guest host this week. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.